to Killing It on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer. And hi, Caitlin Kinnunen.
Hello.
I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, we are so happy you are here. Thank you so much. And what is that dog's name that you're holding so lovingly right
now? This is my dog, Augie. He's a disaster, and I love him so much.
Oh, he is just a dream and a half. For anyone who has followed Caitlin's social media puppy journey, you will see that Augie is a new love of hers who is a rescue dog, and he has epileptic issues. Is that, can we say that?
He has epilepsy, yeah.
He has epilepsy, and Caitlin has been dealing with that like a champion, and it has not been easy. So props to you as a new dog mom.
Thank you. He's especially clingy today because the last 2 days I've been gone working on a project, and so he's been stuck at home with my parents, who he hates. And so today he's like, are you leaving me again? And I'm like, I'm not. Well, but he's just real clingy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only man that I would want to be clingy. You know what I mean? Like,
truly.
That's the only version.
He's the love of my life. I'm gonna live out the rest of my years with this one. So here we are.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We here at the KIOB are thrilled to have our Tony-nominated Broadway pal, Caitlin Kinnunen, with us today.
Thank you.
We have Caitlin, who's Tony-nominated, Jen, who's Tony-nominated, and I think I've been Tony-nominated.
Yeah, you have.
But
you have.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you guys.
You won. I think you won.
I probably did. I wasn't even expecting you guys to say this.
Six-time Tony winner, Jessica Vosk.
This is so crazy. You guys, this is insane. I didn't want to make it about me, but anyway, here we are. But Caitlin, you have a gorgeous, amazing, fabulous career, and we love that. But the thing is, we don't want to talk about it.
No, we're here to talk about murder.
Wow.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right.
Caitlin, you nailed it. You nailed it. Jess
Thank
and I
you.
Are V interested in, yeah, you're welcome. Jess and I are just absolutely interested, V interested in true crime. And since this is a huge case, we're just going to get right to it today.
Let's do it.
So we'd like you to spill it. First of all, before we get to the story,
okay.
Are you in fact interested in true crime at all? And if so, why? Like, when did that start for you?
I go back and forth. Like, sometimes I'm very interested in it, and then I actually, like, take a minute and think about it, and I'm like, oh, I need to chill out. But I think the first thing that got me interested in it was actually a podcast about cults, and I started listening to that, and I was like, whoa, the mind is a fucked up place. and I just think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating.
Go check out a few episodes we did over the holidays. We did some specials, and we did an episode. We interviewed Sarah Edmondson from the Nixium cult, and we did Heaven's Gate recently.
Yeah.
So if you like those things, give it a little listen.
We love a cult. But we don't love a cult. You know what I mean? By saying we love a cult, we mean that we don't agree with the cultish values, but we love covering a cult. We love that you are a fan of, you know, diving into what a cult is.
Yeah.
Again, you know, we have a couple episodes that are cult related. Big ups
I
to
feel
our cult
like
friends.
Cults are a gateway drug to serial killers.
Sure.
In a way.
Sure.
At least for me.
I mean, you know what? We're glad. We want you to feel comfortable in talking about what you feel is a gateway drug to a serial killing time. So knowing that, like, we're glad that we chose today's case.
I'm very excited.
Boy. It traverses several states. And because of that, we could have had guests from Oregon, California, Utah, Colorado, Idaho, and Florida. But we go with where the crimes originated. And that would be in your home state of Washington. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what a wonderful thing for Washington to have. Ted Bundy.
You know... Mm. It's got to, you know, you have to have, they have to originate somewhere. You have to have a claim to fame.
Yeah.
We know that it happens to be Washington, but thank God you came from Washington as well.
Yes.
And you are not Ted Bundy. So
I am not.
Okay.
Anyway, here we go into our story today. But first, we love credit where credit is due. We got some of our information today from Wikipedia, and next to Jack the Ripper, this is probably the most famous serial killer of all time. Kids, this is the case of Ted Bundy. So Ted was born on November 24th in 1946, but as Jen said, because this case is so incredibly dense, we are going to skip his youth, and go to the period of time that psychiatrists think the triggering may have started in his life. So in 1967, Ted was attending the University of Washington, UW, right, Caitlin?
Yes, UW, wonderful. As they say.
UW. Oh, I'm sorry.
They say UW? Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, it's UW. Uh-huh.
Well, see, we say it a bunch of times in this script, so thank God you're here. I would have said UW and just made an ass of myself.
And everyone in Washington would be like, those bitches don't know what they're doing.
Those East Coast elites, what are they doing?
Those East Coast hoes. But anyway, while at UW, he started dating someone who's referred to as the pseudonym Stephanie Brooks. That's not to be confused with Stephanie Block. And in early 1968... Oh, no. Ted dropped out of school, and shortly thereafter, Stephanie ended their relationship due to his, quote, immaturity and lack of ambition. I mean, I have certainly been there and broken up with guys over that, yes. So I get it. So psychiatrist Dorothy Lewis would later pinpoint this crisis as, quote, probably the pivotal time in his development, and Bundy was allegedly devastated by Stephanie's rejection. Now, in the fall of 1969, Ted meets Elizabeth Kleffer, or Liz. And they were seriously involved through 1976. We highly recommend that you watch the documentary Ted Bundy Falling for a Killer on Amazon, where you hear Liz's firsthand account. And as we hear from her daughter as well. And also check out the Netflix documentary Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes. It's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Caitlin already understands how we talk on this show. We do like our killer Delilah voice. So
Delilah! Thank you for that. I loved it.
In mid-1970s, now we're in the mid-1970s, Bundy, he re-enrolls at the University of Washington. Get this, though, he's a psychology major, where he became an honor student and was very well regarded by his professors. And in 1971, he took a job at Seattle's Suicide Hotline Crisis Center, where he met and worked alongside Anne Rule, who was a former Seattle police officer and aspiring crime writer who would later write one of the definitive Bundy biographies called The Stranger Beside Me. Rule saw nothing disturbing in Bundy's personality at the time and described him as kind, solicitous, and empathetic. And all along, Bundy was very involved in Republican politics at this time, and he got accepted into law school. Smart guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I hate this so much.
She hates it.
Smart-ish. Yeah. We'll get there. We'll get there. He had some real self-esteem, as in his own words, self-esteem issues. Issues. If that's an excuse for what issues. Thank you. We're going to liquid you that for the rest of the episode. So now here's where we're going to, Caitlin, hi. And the dog has not moved.
Oh no, he won't. Lord. Don't worry.
Oh, it's so sweet. Oh. Augie is his name?
Augie, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, Augie, listen up, because here's where we get into some manipulative Glenn Close fatal attraction type shit. All right. So during a trip to California on Republican Party business in the summer of 73, Bundy rekindled his relationship with Stephanie Brooks. Now, Stephanie marveled at his transformation into a serious, dedicated professional who was seemingly on the cusp of a legal and political career. Now, Ted, meanwhile, continued to date Liz as well, with neither woman being aware of the other's existence. In the fall of 1973, Bundy matriculated at UPS Law School. Did I say that correctly, Caitlin? UPS Law School?
Yeah.
It's UPS. Right. It's not like, do I say UPS? Should I say UPS? Like,
to my knowledge, no. Yeah. But in this case, people in Washington might be like, wait, no. She's wrong now.
Yeah, I mean, UW. I didn't know if like it was UPS. Okay, so UPS Law, UPS Law School, and continued courting Stephanie, who flew to Seattle several times to stay with him. They even discussed marriage. He actually referred to her as his fiancée when he introduced him to a fellow professor, apparently.
Gross.
But in, yeah, I know. This is my fiancée. Yeah. But in January 1974, however, Ted abruptly broke off all contact. Her phone calls and letters went unreturned. She finally reached him by phone about a month later, and she demanded to know why Bundy had unilaterally ended their relationship without explanation. And in a flat, calm voice, he replied, quote, Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean. And he hung up the phone. She never heard from him again. He later explained, quote, I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her, end quote. Stephanie concluded in retrospect that he had deliberately planned the entire courtship and rejection in advance as vengeance for the breakup she initiated in 1968.
What a douche.
By then, and the thing is, it clearly had an impact, because by then Bundy had begun skipping classes at law school. Mm-hmm. By April, he had stopped attending entirely. And at the same time, young women began to disappear in the Pacific Northwest.
It's fucked up.
Guys, men, I know, I've had a couple moments where I've had where I've broken up with somebody and they've gone a little bit Glenn Close. You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, guys, I'm sorry. He's just not that into you. She's just not that into you. We have to move on. We have to say to ourselves, mantra up, bitch. Mm-hmm. Look in the mirror and say, I'm cool. I'm good. Life goeth on. Let me keep going to law school and make sure that I'm a good person. Is that too simple? Apparently.
And for the record, everyone, this character that Glenn Close portrayed, this is actually who we're referencing. Alex Forrest is one of the greatest characters of all time. Glenn Close was amazing in the role, but we're actually not calling Glenn Close obsessive romantic obsessive.
No.
Can you imagine? No, all of a sudden we get a cease and desist from Glenn Close. I did not stalk anybody.
Like, if you saw me in Sunset Boulevard. No, Glenn, we love you over here, but the character who you played in Fatal Attracts, big ups. So this brings us to shortly after midnight on the date of January 4th, 1974. This is around the same time that he terminated his relationship with Stephanie, where Bundy enters the basement apartment of 18-year-old UW, thank you, student Karen Sparks. He viciously, physically, and sexually assaulted her, and she endured extensive internal injuries, and Karen remained unconscious for 10 days, but she did survive with permanent physical and mental disabilities.
Yeah.
In the early morning, Caitlin, did you just say yeah?
Yeah, I did. Of course.
Okay.
She had mental, what?
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes. Ugh. I mean, you know, this is the type of thing where you just sit as a family member and pray to yourself that they come out of this, you know, and you know that they're not going to come out of it completely unscathed. And she didn't, but thank goodness she survived.
Yes.
And that brings us to the early morning hours of February 1st. Where Bundy broke into the basement room of Linda Ann Healy, a UW undergraduate who broadcast morning radio weather reports for skiers. Now, he beat her unconscious. He dressed her in blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots, and carried her away. Now, during the first half of 1974, female college students disappeared at the rate of about one per month. On March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, a 19-year-old student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, left her dormitory to attend a jazz concert on campus, but never arrived. And on April 17th, Susan Elaine Rancourt disappeared while on her way to her dorm room after an evening advisors meeting at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg. And two female Central Washington students later came forward to report encounters, one on the night of Rancourt's disappearance, the other three nights earlier, with a man wearing an arm sling asking for help carrying a load of books to his brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. Like, so,
I also, as like a Washington State resident, think it's important to note that like these places are not close together. Like, he is traveling to
give us some tips. Give us some stats.
Like, they're hours away from each other. They're not close. He's not like driving down the street to another like town. He's like making a road trip to murder these people.
Yeah.
Do you know that because of Ted Bundy, I studied this in school this fall, that in the profiling of serial killers, one of the fallacies or one of the incorrect things to assume is a lot of people think that serial killers do travel because of what he did.
Yeah.
When really most of them are actually closer to where they live.
Yeah.
But because of Ted Bundy and what he did and his crimes and his pattern was one of the reasons why people make that assumption.
Well, you know, and it's just like we, of course, right. All of these years later, we look at this now and say, if a guy came up to me and was like, hey, ow, my arm, could you help me carry this load of books? I'd be like, let me call my friend Robert to help you as well. Also,
this
indeed.
Real quick, where my father jumps in. My dad is a retired police officer. And last night I was like, do you know anything about Ted Bundy that I should know? He's like, no, just like, don't help people ever. And he's like, especially as women, if a man comes up to you and says he's injured and needs help, it's rude, but you say no. You say no. Don't help people because you might end up dead.
Yeah, and I have to say, as a lover of Caitlin's father, we have met several times, and he's one of the nicest, most amazing people in the entire universe. I must agree with this assessment because, I mean, I live in a city-ish area, and if that were to happen to me, especially if it were nighttime and I was out walking Fred by myself, I would have to not help them and take out my mace. Jen, I was, Dr. Samar.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Vosk. Oh, and Dr. Kinnunen, right? Did I say that right? Is it Kinnunen?
It's Kinnunen. Okay. Dr. Kinnunen. All that's right. Me.
Doc, that's you.
Wow,
Dr.
She
Kinnunen.
Took, she took the title before we even told her she had it.
I may have like listened to your podcast, so I like know the drill.
So you know. Okay. Yeah. We'll be sending you your plaque in the mail. Oh,
thank you so much.
But, mm-hmm. But I will say, ladies, that 19-year-old Jen, if I can talk to myself about myself in the third person.
Sure, definitely.
I think the jury's out at this time if I would have been one of those people to help. Because one of the reasons I think we do say no is because we have all this information. Yeah. You know, I was a child of the 70s and the 80s, and it was different back then. And we didn't have all the information we have now. And the last thing I'll say is I was raised Catholic, very Catholic, and it happened to be a good experience for me growing up. And I was extremely religious and extremely faithful. And, you know, I remember the story of the Good Samaritan, and I might have been like, well, it's my Christian duty to help this person.
Yeah.
You know, and now, of course, I'd be like, I know God loves me. Bye. You know, but I would, you know, anyway, hey, I just
Jesus.
Had to say that.
Thanks,
I just
Jesus.
Feel so, I just feel so much for these kind women. And
of
this,
course.
And this MF-er, obviously, I mean, it's so brilliant, sadly, what he did to lure
100%. Absolutely. Absolutely. So now we get to May 6th, right? We're a couple months after this, and a woman named Roberta Kathleen Parks leaves her dorm at Oregon State University in Corvallis to have coffee with friends at the Memorial Union. But as suspected, she never arrives. So detectives from the King County and Seattle police departments grew increasingly concerned at the time. There was no significant physical evidence, and the missing women had very little in common apart from being young, attractive, white college students with long hair parted in the middle. On June 1st, Brenda Carroll Ball, 22 years old, disappeared after leaving the Flame Tavern in Burien. Is that how I say it, Caitlin?
Burien.
Burien.
Yep, you got it.
After leaving the Flame Tavern in Burien near Seattle, Tacoma International Airport. And she was last seen in the parking lot talking to a brown-haired man with his arm in a sling, y'all. And in the early hours of June 11th, University of Washington student Georgianne Hawkins vanished while walking down a brightly lit alley between her boyfriend's dorm and her sorority house. The next morning, three Seattle homicide detectives and a criminalist combed the entire alleyway on their hands and knees, finding nothing. After Hawkins' disappearance was publicized, witnesses came forward to report seeing a man that night who was in an alley behind a nearby dormitory. He was on crutches with a leg cast and was struggling to carry a briefcase. One woman recalled that the man asked her to help him carry the case to his car, a light brown Volkswagen Beetle. Bundy later stated that he returned to the UW alley the morning after Hawkins' abduction and murder. And there, in the very midst of a major crime scene investigation, he located and gathered Hawkins' earrings and one of her shoes where he had left them in the adjoining parking lot. And he totally departed unobserved. Oh, Ted. And the Pacific Northwest murders. I know. Is that not insane? Oh,
it's
Ted.
It's fucked up.
Truly, like, you think of the movie Serendipity, but in a good way, where you're like, oh, I wish that they could find each other. And this is like the perfect circumstance where you're like, this man pulled into a parking lot and took things that would have been perfect evidence and was not found. Oh, you idjuts. But anyway, the Pacific Northwest murders, they culminated on July 14th with the broad daylight abductions of two women from a crowded beach at Lake Sammamish State Park. And five female witnesses described an attractive young man wearing a white tennis outfit with his left arm in a sling, speaking with a light accent, perhaps Canadian or British. Introducing himself as Ted, he asked, by the way, I want to go back if any casting director is hearing this. It's one of my special skills are accents. Mm-hmm. So introducing himself as Ted, he asked for their help in unloading a sailboat from his tan or bronze covered Volkswagen Beetle. Four of the gals refused. One accompanied him as far as his car, saw that there was no sailboat and fled. And three additional witnesses saw him approach Janice Ann Ott, 23 years old, a probation caseworker at the King County Juvenile Court with the sailboat story and watched her leave the beach in his company. And about 4 hours later, Denise Marie Nasland, a 19-year-old woman who was studying to become a computer programmer, left a picnic to go to the restroom and never returned. King County police, finally armed with a detailed description of their suspect and his car, posted flyers throughout the Seattle area. So a composite sketch was printed in regional newspapers and broadcast on local television stations. Both his girlfriend, Liz, and work associate Ann Rule, as well as DES employee and a UW psychology professor, all recognized the profile, the sketch in the car, and reported Bundy as a possible suspect.
Can you imagine, like, dating someone or, like, being friends with someone and then seeing a composite sketch of them being like, this man has murdered a shit ton of people? Like, what?
I feel like I could have dated that person and Caitlin.
100%. Oh, yeah. And, yeah. Like, same, though.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. I actually can. I'm glad you brought that up, Caitlin, because I can imagine a guy I dated being on America's Most Wanted and me being like, yeah, I'm going to have to call that tip in because was an angry person. But you hope that never happens. I wonder if we've all been, who knows in our lives?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You, like, never know.
So to those ladies, thank you for calling, by the way, and reporting him as a possible suspect. Yes. But here's what really sucks in this situation. The detectives, they were receiving up to 200 tips a day. And so they just immediately thought that it was unlikely that this clean-cut law student with no criminal record could be the perpetrator. So nothing happened there. Now, on September 6th, two grouse hunters stumbled across the skeletal remains of Ott and Naslin near a service road east of Lake Sammamish State Park. An extra femur and several vertebra found at the site were later identified by Bundy as Georgianne Hawkins. Now, 6 months later, forestry students from the Green River Community College discovered the skulls and mandibles of Healy, Rancourt, Parks, and Ball on Taylor Mountain, where Bundy frequently hiked. Ugh. Manson's remains, though, were never recovered.
So in August 1974, Bundy received a second acceptance from the University of Utah Law School and moved to Salt Lake City, leaving Liz in Seattle. While he called Liz often, he dated at least a dozen other women. Can I just pause here? We did not write this in, but having seen the documentaries, I'm so tired of like, oh, he was so handsome. I mean, he's all right. But, you know, like, oh, he was so gorgeous. I'm like, no, stop. No. Anyway. Well,
I think that this is their romanticization. You're welcome. Jeopardy. Uh-huh. Of making this guy seem like, whoa, he could have never been this killer. He was so clean cut. And the women thought he was amazing. Like,
and then you go and have better. A movie made where Zac Efron plays him. And so you have people who have not done the research of what actually happened. And they see handsome Zac Efron playing this like charismatic man who just like happened to murder a couple of people. And they're like, oh, he's so handsome.
Yeah, we don't need it. We don't love it. Yeah. We don't want it.
We don't love it. Thanks, Jessica. We just don't love it. We don't love it. So anyway, when he studied the first year law curriculum a second time, he was devastated, to your point earlier, Jessica, to find out that the other students had something or some intellectual capacity that he did not. He found the classes completely incomprehensible. Quote, it was a great disappointment to me, end quote. And I read in a book that he had self-esteem issues because of that. Oh, and he that might be one totally. Of the, and that might be one of the reasons that he, I don't know, decided to become a serial killer. I know. It's so, because none of us know disappointments and none of us have broken up or had been broken up with.
I've never heard the word no, honestly. I would say that I've had a thriving time of only hearing yes and only being told how amazing I am on a daily basis by producers and directors alike. So,
correct.
I just can't relate. It's so hard. No. I feel so bad for him. Take it away. Jen, take it away.
So I'm getting us back. You're getting us back here. A new string of homicides began the following month, including two that would remain undiscovered until Bundy confessed to them shortly before his execution. On September 2nd, he sexually assaulted and murdered a still unidentified hitchhiker in Idaho. On October 2nd, he seized 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox in Holladay, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Her remains were buried near Capitol Reef National Park, some 200 miles south of Holladay, but were never found. On October 18th, Melissa Ann Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of the police chief of Midvale, which was another Salt Lake City suburb, disappeared after leaving a pizza parlor. Her remains were found in a nearby mountainous area 9 days later. On October 31st, Laura Ann Amy, also 17, disappeared 25 miles south in Lehigh after leaving a cafe just after midnight. Her remains were found by hikers 9 miles to the northeast in American Fork Canyon on Thanksgiving Day. In the late afternoon of November 8th, and I think you two ladies I know this, and probably most of the listeners, because this was covered very well in Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes. and it's truly riveting. But Bundy approached 18-year-old telephone operator Carol Durant at Fashion Place Mall in Murray, less than a mile from the Midvale restaurant where Melissa Smith was last seen. He identified himself as Officer Roseland of the Murray Police Department and told Durant that someone had attempted to break into her car. He asked her to accompany him to the station to file a complaint. When she pointed out to Bundy that he was driving on a road that did not lead to the police station, he immediately pulled to the shoulder and attempted to handcuff her. During their struggle, he inadvertently fastened both handcuffs to the same wrist, and she was able to open the car door and escaped. And you must go watch it because her description in the first person is riveting about, was going bananas to flag down a car. And apparently it enraged him. And she feels really sad about what happened next because he was clearly on a mission to enact this crime. And he later that evening went to Viewmont High School in Bountiful, where there was Deborah Jean Kent, a 17-year-old student. She disappeared after leaving a theater production at the school to pick up her brother. The school's drama teacher and a student told police that a stranger had asked each of them to come out to the parking lot to identify a car. Another student later saw the same man pacing in the rear of the auditorium, and the drama teacher spotted him again shortly before the end of the play. Outside the auditorium, investigators found a key that unlocked the handcuffs that were removed from Carol Durant's wrist. So he went, I don't know what you call that, spiraling. There's a word for that, but he was going to rape and murder someone.
Yeah. And he just had to keep going until he actually did it.
Yeah. Oh, it's awful.
I mean, one track mind had a, complete need to fulfill whatever it was that he, the hunger inside to do something shitty, even worse than shitty. That's not even a word that I could possibly use to explain this. Yeah. But yes, he did, for lack of a better term, spiral down whatever, black hole he was in to have to commit one of these murders when. Thank God this woman was able to get out of the car, but then it pissed him off even more. So he's got it together.
He had to feed this compulsion.
And hot tip from Dad Kinnunen, always carry a handcuff key. Put it on your keychain.
Oh. I love your dad. Listen to me. Listen to me when I say this, listeners. Caitlin's dad has helped me with police gear, okay?
Yeah.
I love.
And by police gear, he sent you a hat.
I understand that.
Just clarify
to me. And he also sent me a flashlight.
Oh, he's very into only using flashlights. He says two is one is none. You can't use the flashlight on your phone. That's your backup flashlight. You have to have a real flashlight to use.
But the one he sent me is the best flashlight I've ever had, and it's the size of a small tiny figurine. Yeah.
He knows this shit.
So I'm passionate about his tips, his hot
handcuff
tips.
Handcuff keys, flashlight, and knife at all times.
But the handcuff keys, where would you store it? In your gum line?
In a pocket, in your bag.
What if you can't reach your pocket? But you can always take your tongue and in a prison moment, you slide it out. You could sew a flap of skin open.
I knew she was going to
stick it in there.
I knew you were going to do that.
I think that's the answer. We should all sew it. Sew flaps of skin into our cheeks to keep handcuff keys. I think that's the conclusion of this episode.
Thank you, goodbye. I'm about to go to my Botox stock and have it.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song.
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
Sis, not to talk filler all day, but why don't you just sew a hole in my cheek?
This is disturbing. Okay, can you please start talking about Ted again?
I like this plan, and I'm proud to be a part of it. Now, in November, Bundy's girlfriend Liz called King County Police a second time after reading that young women were disappearing in towns surrounding Salt Lake City. And then, I guess they didn't really take her seriously because in December, she had to call again. She called the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office and repeated her suspicions. Bundy's name was added to their list of suspects, but at that time, no credible forensic evidence linked him to the Utah crimes. In January 1975, Bundy returned to Seattle after his final exams and spent a week with Liz, who did not tell him that she had reported him to police on three occasions. Go, ma'am.
That week must have been hell for her. Like, yeah, boyfriend, come on back. Spend a week in my home with, like, my child, right? And then I know you're killing people and I've reported you multiple times, but I'm going to pretend everything's fine.
That is some, I mean, that's skill, first of all.
Yeah.
And I would never want to be.
Talk about
position.
Tony nominees.
That'll be what asshole. My nomination's for. No, that'll be what it's for. For creating
for
a
what?
Role like that.
Your
for
seventh that win.
For the role of Liz.
What's the thing in our mouths? What is it?
It's a handcuff key.
It's a cuff key.
Cuff key killer. Cuff key killings.
Not
starring, you know, Jessica Vosk.
Yeah, it's a one-act play.
Oh, wow. You know, it's a drama.
Not to be confused with Officer Krupke. We'll talk about it later, but I'm going to take us onward.
Okay.
Now, in 1975, Bundy, he shifts much of his criminal activity eastward from his base in Utah to Colorado. And on January 12th, a 23-year-old registered nurse named Karen Eileen Campbell disappeared while walking down a well-lit hallway between the elevator and her room at the Wildwood Inn, which is now the Wildwood Lodge, y'all, in Snowmass Village. Now, her remains were found a month later next to a dirt road just outside the resort. On March 15th, 100 miles northeast of Snowmass, Vail ski instructor Julie Cunningham, age 26, disappeared while walking from her apartment to a dinner date with a friend. And Bundy later told Colorado investigators that he approached Cunningham on crutches and asked her to help carry his ski boots to the car. Now, Denise Lynn Oliverson, 25 years old, disappeared near the Utah-Colorado border in Grand Junction on April 6th while riding her bicycle to her parents' house. Her bike and sandals were found under a viaduct near a railroad bridge. And on May 6th, Bundy lured 12-year-old Lynette Dawn Culver from Alameda Junior High School in Pocatello, Idaho, and disposed of her body in a river north of Pocatello. On June 28th, Susan Curtis vanished from the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo. Curtis's murder became Bundy's last confession, tape-recorded moments before he entered the execution chamber. Ew. The bodies of Wilcox, Kent, Cunningham, Oliverson, Culver, and Curtis were never recovered. Ooh. Now, let's get back to Washington State, shall we?
Okay.
Investigators, they were still, Caitlin, we're taking you back home.
Thank you.
We don't want you to worry.
No.
But now investigators were still struggling to analyze the Pacific Northwest murder spree that had ended as abruptly as it had begun. So in an effort to make sense of an overwhelming mass of data, they resorted to the then innovative strategy of what? Compiling a database. And after inputting the many lists they had compiled, classmates and acquaintances of each victim, Volkswagen owners named Ted, known sex offenders, and so on, they queried the computer for coincidences. And out of thousands of names, 26 turned up on four lists. One was Ted Bundy. Detectives also manually compiled a list of their 100 best suspects. This is a very, like, Time Magazine's 100 best. And Bundy was on that list as well. And he was literally at the top of the pile of suspects when word came from Utah of his arrest. Oof. On August 16th. Isn't that nuts?
It's crazy.
I mean, all of these years later, but still, I always believe karma is going to come back. But on August 16th of 1975, Bundy was arrested by Utah Highway Patrol officer Bob Hayward. Now, Hayward had observed Bundy cruising a residential area in the pre-dawn hours, and Bundy fled the area at high speed after seeing the patrol car. The officer searched the car after he noticed that the Volkswagen's front passenger seat had been removed and placed on the rear seats. Like, ding, ding. That's weird. AF. Mm-hmm. He found a ski mask, a second mask fashioned from pantyhose, a crowbar, handcuffs, trash bags, a coil of rope, an ice pick, and other items initially assumed to be burglary tools. Bundy explained that the ski mask was for skiing. He had found the officer.
Yes, thank you.
Stop. I removed that passenger seat because I might have found a snowman. And by the way, mask is for skiing, and that he had found the handcuffs in a dumpster, and the rest were common household items. Now, However, Detective Jerry Thompson remembered a similar suspect and car description from the November 1974 Duranche kidnapping, which matched Bundy's name from Liz's December 1974 phone call. In a search of Bundy's apartment, police found a guide to the Colorado ski resorts with a checkmark by the Wildwood Inn and a brochure that advertised the Viewmont High School play in Bountiful, where Deborah Kent had disappeared. The police did not have sufficient evidence to detain Bundy at the time, and he was later released on his own recognizance. And Bundy later said that searchers missed a hidden collection of Polaroid photographs of his victims, which he destroyed after he was released.
Nope.
I just want to take a second. Right. Caitlin is in it. Mm-hmm. She's in it. And I want to just say, Dr. Kinnunen, that we appreciate you being in it. You hear the audio, so we like to tell our listeners, like, shit's going down on our Zoom call right now.
Yeah. He was like, oh yeah, I just found those handcuffs in a dumpster and decided to keep them. Like, mm-hmm. What the fuck?
It seems right. It seems
super cash.
Like, good on that police officer for being like, yeah, no.
Mm-hmm. Listen, we've got a guy who thinks he's going to outsmart everybody. Let's mm-hmm. be real. He thinks that he's got his shit together.
He does not.
Of course, has an answer for everything, but so did I when I was three. My mom was like, did you hit your brother? And I was like, no. And she was like, but I actually saw you hit your brother. And I was like, but I didn't. You know, like, that's kind of me thinking about Ted being like, guys, of course my passenger seat is out. I was literally skiing. Who knows what could have came in my car? And that pantyhose right there is because I wore it as long johns. Like, he just has an answer for everything.
Yeah.
Now, in September, this is a big thing. He sells his Volkswagen Beetle, sells it. And now Utah police, they impounded it and FBI techs dismantled and searched it. Thank God. They found hairs matching samples obtained from Karen Campbell's body. And later they also identified hair strands, quote, microscopically indistinguishable from those of Melissa Smith and Carol Duranche. FBI lab specialist Robert Neal concluded that the presence of hair strands in one car matching three different victims who had never met one another would be, quote, a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Duh. Now, on October 2nd, this is always a favorite thing of mine is when they put the suspect into a lineup. I don't know why. If anybody is into The Night Stalker, the documentary right now on Netflix mm-hmm. of The Night Stalker, huge lineup moment. Big fan.
It's very theatrical. I mean,
yes, maybe that's why thing. I like it. Yeah. But this happens on October 2nd where detectives put Bundy into a lineup and Duranche immediately identified him as Officer Roseland. And witnesses from Bountiful recognized him as the stranger at the high school auditorium. There was insufficient evidence to link him to Deborah Kent, but there was more than enough evidence to charge him with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault in the Duranche case. But he was freed on $15,000 bail paid by his parents and spent most of the time between indictment and trial in Seattle, living in Liz's house. You guys, he lived in Liz's house.
No. Liz,
no girl, get out, girl. And Seattle police had insufficient evidence to charge him in the Pacific Northwest murders, but they did keep him under close surveillance. Dr. Samard.
Yes. So in February of 1976, Bundy stood trial for the Duranche kidnapping, which again, you can see if you go watch that documentary. And she was so brave, you know, like all of the witnesses. So bravo, ladies. Amazing. On the advice of his attorney, Bundy waived his right to a jury due to the negative publicity surrounding the case. After a 4-day bench trial and a weekend of deliberation, Judge Stuart Hansen Jr. found him guilty of kidnapping and assault. In June, he was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in the Utah State Prison. In October, he was found hiding in the bushes in the prison yard, carrying an escape kit, which, you know, consisted of roadmaps, airline schedules, and a social security card. He spent several weeks in solitary confinement. And later that month, Colorado authorities charged him with Karen Campbell's murder. After a period of resistance, he waived extradition proceedings and on June 7th, 1977, was transferred to Garfield County Jail in Glenwood Springs to Pitkin County Courthouse. Say that 10 times fast.
No, thank you.
Okay.
I'm good.
Yeah, this is in Aspen for a preliminary hearing. He had elected to serve as his own attorney and as such was excused by the judge from wearing handcuffs or leg shackles.
This is where it gets so good.
Mm-hmm. So during a recess, he asked to visit the courthouse's law library to research his case. While shielded from his guard's view behind a bookcase, he opened a window and jumped to the ground from the second story, injuring his right ankle as he landed.
Oh, so now he really injures his ankle. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like all these other things, he was like Tiny Tim. Sorry.
Jessica.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Fine. All right. So here we go. After shedding an outer layer of clothing, Ted walked through Aspen as roadblocks were being set up on its outskirts. He then hiked southward onto Aspen Mountain. Near its summit, he broke into a hunting cabin and stole food, clothing, and a rifle. The following day, he left the cabin and continued south toward the town of Crested Butte and became lost in the forest. For 2 days, he wandered aimlessly on the mountain, missing two trails that led downward to his intended destination.
Poor oblivious on June 10th, Ted.
Right? I mean, guys, he was probably that close to actually escaping.
He could have escaped. You know? And yeah. He just didn't.
Maybe he wasn't so bright after all.
I was going to say. This brings us to, hey, smarty pants. You know, changed his pants, not so smart, you know?
No Les Stroud, no Bear Grylls in our midst. Anyway, on June 10th, he broke into a camping trailer on Maroon Lake, 10 miles south of Aspen, taking food and a ski parka. But instead of continuing southward, he walked back north toward Aspen, eluding roadblocks and search parties along the way. 3 days later, he stole a car at the edge of Aspen Golf Course. He was cold, sleep-deprived, and in constant pain from his sprained ankle. So he drove back into Aspen, where two police officers noticed his car weaving in and out of its lane as they pulled him over. He had been a fugitive for 6 days. In the car were maps of the mountain area around Aspen that prosecutors were using to demonstrate the location of Karen Campbell's body. As his own attorney, Bundy had rights of discovery, indicating that his escape was not a spontaneous act, but it had been planned. Bundy was back in jail, but not for long. He acquired a detailed floor plan of the jail and a hacksaw blade from other inmates. As well, he accumulated $500 in cash. During the evenings, while other prisoners were showering, he sawed a hole about 1 square foot between the steel reinforcing bars in his cell's ceiling. And having lost 35 pounds, he was able to wriggle through it into the crawl space above. And this is another thing. I'm going to pause. There's not a woman in the world who would be able to lose 35 pounds in a week. And this is why men suck when it comes to losing weight.
I would never be able to fit through that.
Oh, absolutely not. I'd have to saw my tits off.
Right? But these men, I'm sorry to make it about dieting. I don't know if I'm going to keep this in, but these men, they go on these weight loss shows, they're like, you lost 40 pounds in 3 days. And meanwhile, women are working their literal asses off. And 3 months later, I lost 6 pounds. Anyway.
Right. Because I literally eat one bite of penne. That's it for me. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And like a guy can be like, I just need a whole box of penne and I can't gain a pound.
I can't keep it on me.
Yeah, exactly. Disgusting.
So anyway. Where was I? I'm not sure.
Well, you're at the fact that he lost 35 pounds so he could wriggle in.
So having lost 35 pounds, he was able to wriggle through it into the crawl space above. In the weeks that followed, he made a series of practice runs exploring the space, and on the night of December 30th, with most of the jail staff on Christmas break and nonviolent prisoners on furlough with their families, Bundy piled books and files onto his bed, covered them with a blanket to simulate his sleeping body, and he climbed into the crawl space. He broke through the ceiling into the apartment of the chief jailer, who was out for the evening with his wife. He changed into street clothes from the jailer's closet and walked out the front door to freedom. The jail's skeletal crew did not discover the escape until noon on New Year's Eve on December 31st, more than 17 hours later. By then, Bundy was already in Chicago.
Bundy was like, bye, bitch.
I'm sorry, though. Mm-hmm. What movie fairy tale are we living in where this happens at a jail? I'm like,
right?
Do you know what I mean? I cannot fathom somebody being like, all right.
Yeah.
So I got $500 from selling some cigs and I was able to get my books into a row to look like I was sleeping. I wriggled my way through this thing. The cameras,
nobody noticed.
Bob number one and Joe number two were like, we got your back, bro. Like, where are we?
Well, true. One thing I want to say, a side note, Carol Boone, who comes up later in the story, is someone he has had a relationship with.
Yeah.
Throughout this period. And she becomes very, Yeah, she becomes very important to the case later. But apparently she gave him the $500, which I did not know until researching this.
Not good, for Carol. Today's.
Yeah, but I will say, hopefully we'll post a picture of it, but you can see part of the reason he stacked books, I believe, is to reach the height of the ceiling, because he was tall, right? And so he got on the top bunk on the stacked items and then made it through the ceiling. But to your point, I wonder if it's cases like this and Alcatraz, of course, which is famous, where now you see prisons and there you get a steel bed that's into the wall and a steel pot to you know what in, and everything's just very sterile. Mm-hmm. Because of, I'm sure that's part of it, right? As opposed to these beds and these rooms where you can move stuff around. And,
oh yeah. Hell no. Right? I mean, I do watch a lot of prison shows, if you will. Thank you, America. and prisoners do find ways, this is not escaping or anything, but prisoners do find innovative ways to stay in touch with each other, like talking through a toilet. Mm-hmm. Which is the thing that they do that I found to be quite creative and innovative and not, you know, an escape tactic. So we're getting toward the home stretch here, Caitlin. And this is where Bundy now arrives in Tallahassee, Florida, great little town, on the morning of January 8th, where he rents a room under the alias Chris Hagen at the Holiday Inn near the Florida State University, or FSU, or as I like to call it, FSU campus.
FSU.
And Bundy later said, yeah, FSU, that's what they call it. And Bundy later said that he initially resolved to find legitimate employment and refrain from further criminal activity, knowing he could probably remain free and undetected in Florida indefinitely, as long as he did not attract the attention of police. Okay, mm-hmm. I get it, because it's Florida, and Florida's a little, you know, hoojumawatsa anyway, But on his lone job application at a construction site, it had to be abandoned when he was asked to produce identification. He reverted to his old habits of shoplifting and stealing credit cards from women's wallets left in shopping carts.
It just took one little thing.
What'd you say?
He was like, it just took that one little thing. He was like, I'm going to live a good life now. And then they were like, oh, we need ID. And he was like, God damn it. Going to go back and kill people now.
Or he was like, oh, got to go to that Walmart where I saw Karen drop her ID again. and that's what it, so here we get to the early hours yet again. And the date is January 15th, 1978, which is 1 week after his arrival in Tallahassee, where Bundy enters FSU's Chi Omega sorority house through a rear door with a faulty locking mechanism. Beginning about 2:45 a.m., he murdered Margaret Bowman, aged 21. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa Levy, where he sexually assaulted and murdered her. In an adjoining bedroom, he attacked Kathy Kleiner and Karen Chandler. Chandler and Kleiner survived the attack, and Kleiner later attributed their survival to automobile headlights illuminating the interior of their room and frightening away the attacker. Now, Tallahassee detectives later determined that the four attacks took place in a total of less than 15 minutes, within earshot of more than 30 witnesses who heard nothing. After leaving the sorority house, Bundy broke into a basement apartment 8 blocks away and attacked FSU student Cheryl Thomas, dislocating her shoulder and fracturing her jaw and skull in 5 places. She was left with permanent deafness and an equilibrium damage that ended her dance career. On Thomas's bed, police found a semen stain and a pantyhose mask containing 2 hairs, quote, similar to Bundy's in class and characteristic. Now, on February 8th, Bundy drove 150 miles east to Jacksonville in a stolen FSU van. In a parking lot, he approached 14-year-old Leslie Parmenter, the daughter of Jacksonville Police Department's chief of detectives. He identified himself as, quote, Richard Burton, fire department, but retreated when Parmenter's older brother arrived and challenged him. Oh, thank God, older bro.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that afternoon, he backtracked 60 miles westward to Lake City. At Lake City Junior High the following morning, 12-year-old Kimberly Diane Leach was summoned to her homeroom by a teacher to retrieve a forgotten purse. She never returned to class after that. 7 weeks later, after an intensive search, her partially mummified remains were found in a pig farrowing shed near Suwannee River State Park. On February 12th, with insufficient cash to pay his overdue rent and a growing suspicion that police were closing in on him, Bundy stole a car, fled Tallahassee, drove westward across the Florida Panhandle. And 3 days later, around 1 a.m., he was stopped by the Pensacola police officer David Lee near the Alabama state line after a, quote, wants and warrants check showed his Volkswagen Beetle was stolen. When told he was under arrest, Bundy kicked Lee's legs out from under him and took off running. Lee fired a warning shot followed by a second round, gave chase, and tackled him. The two struggled over Lee's gun before the officer finally subdued and arrested Bundy. In the stolen vehicle, there were three sets of IDs belonging to female FSU students. There were 21 stolen credit cards and, why not, a stolen television set. And also found were a pair of dark-rimmed, non-prescription glasses and a pair of plaid slacks, later identified as the disguise worn by Richard Burton, fire department, in Jacksonville. And as Lee transported his suspect to jail, unaware that he had just arrested one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, he heard Bundy say, quote, "I wish you had killed me."
Ooh. Okay. Now, two things before I bring us on home. Number one, in that documentary we keep hawking here, you can see a mark on Ted Bundy's face in the courtroom, and that is from that struggle with the police officer, if I'm remembering it correctly. So go check that out. Ooh. And number two, let's just talk about Ted deciding which car to steal. You know, he's like, just a Mercedes, a Ford Escort, you know what, a Beetle again. Like, he just, you know, like, you had to pick the same car because he's...
And this is where you get to, like, as smart as you could be as far as law is concerned, then you just have these street smart fails. Mm-hmm. Not a street smart gent, you know? Mm-hmm. Let me keep all these IDs. Let me keep all these credit cards. Let me do the same pattern as I've done before, which obviously I'm going to get caught.
All right, so bring us on home here. Caitlin, you're a champ. Do you need some water?
Champ,
you're
Caitlin.
Good?
No, I'm here for it.
Okay, here we go.
So is Augie.
So following a change of venue to Miami, Bundy stood trial for the Chi Omega homicides and assaults in June 1979. Despite the presence of five court-appointed attorneys, Bundy again handled much of his own defense. Narcissism table for one. Yeah. At trial, At trial, crucial testimony came from Chi Omega sorority members Connie Hastings, who placed Bundy in the vicinity of the Chi Omega house that evening, and Nita Neary, who saw him leaving the sorority house clutching the Oak murder weapon. Brave women. Thank you. Incriminating physical evidence included impressions of the bite wounds Bundy had inflicted on Lisa Levy's left buttock, which forensic odontologist Richard Suverone and Lowell Levine matched to castings of Bundy's teeth. The jury deliberated for less than 7 hours before convicting him on July 24, 1979, of the Bowman and Levy murders. Three counts of attempted first-degree murder for the assaults on Kleiner, Chandler, and Thomas, and two counts of burglary. Trial Judge Edward Cowart imposed death sentences for the murder convictions. 6 months later, a second trial took place in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. Bundy was found guilty once again after less than 8 hours deliberation, due principally to the testimony of an eyewitness who saw him leading Leach from the schoolyard to his stolen van. Important material evidence included clothing fibers with an unusual manufacturing error found in the van and on Leach's body, which matched fibers from the jacket Bundy was wearing when he was arrested. During the penalty phase of the trial, Bundy took advantage of an obscure Florida law providing that a marriage declaration in court in the presence of a judge constituted a legal marriage. As Bundy was questioning long-term friend Carol Ann Boone, who we brought up earlier, Miss $500, was testifying on his behalf as a character witness, he asked her to marry him. She accepted. Oh, yeah. It's in the documentary. Go look. She accepted.
Because I watched it, but all I can think of right now is $500,600.
That was beautiful. So Carol accepted, and Bundy declared to the court that they were legally married. In October 1981, Boone gave birth to a daughter and named Bundy as the father. While conjugal visits were not allowed at Rayford Prison, inmates were known to pool their money in order to bribe guards to allow them intimate time alone with their female visitors.
Woof.
On February 10th, 1980, Bundy was sentenced for a third time to death by electrocution. I just want to say this. Kimberly Leach has always stuck in my head because she was so young, right? She was 12 years old. And until we did this episode today, I had forgotten about Lynette Dawn Culver in Idaho, who was also 12, which I know you had a visceral reaction to, ladies. And so I guess, God bless, she's not as well known as Kimberly Leach because this trial centered around poor, Kimberly
crazy
Diane
to
Leach.
Me is that he gets convicted for just this like handful of murders that he committed, but there are so many more that just went like A, unsolved, or B, like, oh, well, we're just going to like lump him in with this one. We got him, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just like, it's so unfortunate because that happens all the time. How do we give and pay respect to all of the people who he brutally assaulted and murdered? And like, yes. The justice system is a mess.
And the justice for the families. And we often talk about the justice. What does that word mean? It's not a word we even really like because it's so different for everyone, isn't it?
But in the case of murder, it's like, no, justice has to be found because that, ugh, God. Yeah. Anyway, that's, I'm going to step off my soapbox. Okay. Please
continue. We love your soapbox. No, we love it. It's like a Lever 2000 cleansing all of our 2000 parts in our brains.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
I would come to Hyde Park and see you in Soapbox Corner anytime. All right. But getting back to this, we're nearly there. In early 1986, an execution date of March 4th was set on the Chi Omega convictions. The Supreme Court issued a brief stay, but the execution was quickly rescheduled. In April, shortly after the new date, July 2nd, was announced, Bundy finally confessed to details of what he did to some of his victims after their deaths. Okay. And trigger warning, guys, here are some unpleasant details, so trigger warning. So Ted Bundy, he revisited the crime scenes, often several times, to lie with his victims and perform sexual acts with their decomposing bodies. In some cases, he drove for several hours each way and remained the entire night. In Utah, he applied makeup to Melissa Smith's lifeless face, and he repeatedly washed Laura Amy's hair. He decapitated approximately 12 of his victims with a hacksaw and kept at least one group of severed heads, probably the four later found on Taylor Mountain, in his apartment for a period of time before disposing of them. After several failed appeals and motions, a firm execution date of January 24th, 1989 was announced. With all appeal avenues exhausted and no further motivation to deny his crimes, among the things he told them was that he had incinerated one of his victims' heads in Liz's fireplace. Quote, of all, I know, yeah, I didn't know that either. Quote, of all the things I did to Liz, this is probably the one she is least likely to forgive me for. Poor Liz, end quote.
Okay, come on, bro.
Mm-hmm.
How is
the fact that he said poor Liz? Like,
yeah, he let me say it again. He says, quote, of all the things I did to Liz, this is probably the one she is least likely to forgive me for, poor Liz. That is according to Wikipedia. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, no shit, poor Liz. You and probably, I'm just guessing here that the amount of therapy Liz has had to go through, or at least, you know, hopefully she has gotten some help in working these things out that didn't have anything to do with her, but you know, I'm sure there's some kind of association of guilt involved with being a part of this man's life.
Yeah. So now, upon confessing to the crimes, Boone, his wife, who had championed Bundy's innocence throughout all of his trials, felt deeply betrayed by his admission that he was in fact guilty. There were some other details there. I think maybe he was romantically involved with someone else, but regardless, she moved back to Washington with her daughter and refused to accept his phone call on the morning of his execution. Bundy died in the electric chair at 7:16 a.m. on January 24th, 1989. Hundreds of revelers sang, danced, and set off fireworks in a pasture across from the prison as the execution was carried out, then cheered as the white hearse containing Bundy's corpse departed the prison. He was cremated in Gainesville and his ashes scattered at an undisclosed location in the Cascade Range of Washington State in accordance with his will. And I know, I don't like that either.
He's still here.
And that, well, yeah, and you know, and I'm going to say that's our horrible tale of Ted Bundy. And I couldn't agree more with you, Caitlin, and I don't want to speak for you, Jess, but I suspect you'll feel the same way. I know those were his wishes, but spreading his ashes on the mountains where the remains of some of his victims remain really bothers me. Right? Yeah. It's like that whole thing. He talks about wanting to possess them, and it's just, it's awful. So yes,
like,
go ahead.
I don't know. I feel like if you have killed that many people, you don't get your last wishes. Like, what? Like, no. I feel very strongly that, like, you don't get to say, yeah, will you please scatter my ashes in the Cascades? Like, no, yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. I won't. You murdered so many people.
And I'm going to say that while I do believe everyone is human, everyone makes mistakes, this is another level. This is a total another, we're in a different playing field here. We're in a playing field where somebody not only is able to tell you what he did to some of his victims, not disclose every single one of his victims, decide to sort of pick and choose what he tells authorities, doing something in the house of a girlfriend of his, an ex-girlfriend of his, you know, with the wherewithal. It's not like this guy was, you know, saying I'm a different person and I have a, you know, borderline personality disorder. Like, no, he knew what he was doing. This was all very, very maniacal, manipulative since the dawn of his murdering time. So I have to agree. I wouldn't say, yeah, let's go ahead and do what he would want, because I really feel like he learned from this experience. That's just not the case.
One caveat I'll say is, and again, it's heartbreaking, is his mother. His mother was devastated by this, right? So I'm not sure who took possession of his remains.
True.
But I can understand where his mother seems so sweet and so loving, and you really don't get the impression that she was anything but a good mom. And it's just,
That's why it's so scary.
That is true. That is a good point. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know what? Look at us coming from different angles. We're listening to caveats. We're listening to new points. We're listening to old points. It's quite a disgusting thing. There's not something really exciting for us to discuss these cases of serial killers who seemingly had gotten away with so many things until, you know, they were discovered due to, you know, databases or new technology, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that someone, and Jen and I often talk about this with the guests that are on, it's sort of, you know, is a killer born into this? Do they have this already within their system, or are they made into being these killers? And in when we did the Night Stalker case, he was made into being a killer. Where does Ted, if we were to give our doctoral expertise in this situation, where does he fall into it? I'm like, I feel like he was born with that shit. I don't know.
He blamed a lot on pornography too.
Get out of town.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people who would be serial killers, you know.
But I also, like, there's something to that, because there is a lot of violent pornography out there that is very accessible. And if you have someone who's already compromised and then they're seeing this and it's being glorified to them, like, I don't think that's
But where in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, would we be finding that kind of porn?
Magazines.
But isn't there something, wasn't something said, like, I read somewhere that like he sought out magazines like that and would like look at them and cut out the photos when he was younger, you know, like, I don't know. I feel,
again, it's in the documentary. I'm a doctor. It's in the
fantastic. I'm a doctor. And I really think that it was a combo platter of, like, you know, a little bit born in, little bit society.
I have a question, though, Caitlin. You said earlier in this episode, as a resident of Washington State, how far apart these places were. And I just want to know, you know, have you been to the Cascade Range of Washington State or any other things that you think we might want to know as a local about this? Please tell us.
It's funny because, like, I didn't know much about Ted Bundy until I watched that documentary, The Conversations with a Killer. And I really remember watching it with my roommate, who was also from Washington, and she knew more about it than I did, and being like, he was in Issaquah? No. Issaquah is where I grew up doing theater. That was my first professional show, was in Issaquah. And I remember being like, wait, he got them on Lake Sammamish? And being like, I've been there. I know these places. And the fact that this shit happens in your backyard. You know,
I mean, I mean, obviously you're not going to remember because you were not born it, but like,
no, I'm very young, Jess. God,
honestly, same. But I just wanted to say to you, like, did you hear anything from your parents about, like, you know, people who wouldn't lock their doors or who would, like, then lock their doors? Because you know, in all these areas, especially in the 70s and 80s and even early 90s, people, I know people who came from the Midwest or they were transplants and they wound up in California or in Washington, they were like, we don't lock our doors. Like, we're just not that type of, we're just trusting folks and we don't lock our doors. And I still know people who don't lock their doors to this day. I'm like, I'm in an apartment building. Like, you can't get to my apartment and I'm still like, I lock 62 locks. So
yeah, of course you do. I mean, I think my experience with that was a little bit different because my dad was a cop growing up. Everything was locked.
That's true.
Everything was locked, and we are constantly told, keep your head up, keep your head on a swivel. Like, you look around, you don't walk around with your phone in your hand, you pay attention to what is going on around you. You don't say yes to people, you just continue on, you know, like last night asking my dad about all of this, he just reiterated you see lions and tigers and bears, their head is always up. They are the predator and they are looking around, and you make sure you know where you are. It's like the lambs and the deer and all of those animals that their head is down and they're just like grazing, and that's why they get eaten.
Oh, shit.
All right, you heard it here. Be a lion. Be the predator.
Don't be the bunny. Don't be the bunny.
Don't be the predator in the sense that you are the killer, but be the predator in the sense of, like, you know what's going on around you.
Smart.
That's right. That's so smart. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Caitlin, I love you so much.
Bye. Love you. We love you.
Bye. I love you so much.
You're the best. We love you, and we love Augie. Woof, woof. Get out of here. I love you.
Well, she's delightful.
She is delightful. Listen, Caitlin and I have been friends since we met during the Bridges of Madison County in 2014.
I love that.
She has been one of my best besties ever since, both in Fiddler on the Roof and in Wicked. She painted her face to be from Sarah and Elphaba, and she lip sync. And I treasure those videos. So she's a gem. We think that you are all gems. Thank you for listening to this episode today, killers. We love you so much, crime fam. We know this was a crazy one. So thank you very much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at @KillingItOnBroadway and Twitter at @KillingItOnBway.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.